accession number 15212, Real 2.
Monty Fisher, Real 2.
The children were tolerated rather than brought into the family really as one of the family. That's not to say that they weren't by and large very well looked after, but there were of course incidents where there were problems between the children and the people they were billeted with. Now, one used to think, because we had these odd discussions, that sometimes it may have been a cynical approach of the youngsters, simply because they weren't clever enough to understand or to appreciate the billeter's point of view. But one sometimes thought that quite a number of people were billeting the children for the 14 and sixpence, or the 10 and sixpence that they got earlier, for having them, billeting them. Now, I used to think, in my particular case, that they made a good profit out of me, because the amount of money, I'll give you an example. I know they used to send me out to the local baker's, and Mr. Duffy, who was an elderly gentleman with a lovely white beard, a very nice person, kept this little bakehouse, and I used to go to him for a pennant of dough. "Can I have a pennant of dough, Mr. Duffy?" "What's that, boy?" "I like a pennant of dough." And he'd say, "Right, wait a minute, boy." He'd go to the bakehouse and come back with a pat of dough. And I'd take this home, and my billeter, Mrs. Ruffles, would take that dough, and then we'd have the lunch. Now, the lunch would consist of the following. This joint of meat was put on the table. This dough, which had been cooked, on another plate. And there were some vegetables. She would take that plate with the pan of the dough, cut it in halves, and then cut each half, the first half, into three separate sections. One she'd put on a plate for me, one for herself, one for her husband. And she'd pour gravy over there. And that would be our, quote, hors d'oeuvre, unquote, special meal. Then we'd have the meat with potatoes and some vegetable, probably carrots or something like that. And then she would turn to the next remaining half of this pennyworth of dough and cut it into three parts, put one piece on my plate, one for herself, one for her husband, and take some jam and put some jam over that. And that was our dessert. You see, on the basis of that. And the other thing that happened very regularly, which was that we'd go, Mr. Ruffles and I, would go to the local fish and chip shop, and for 1 shilling, he would order 4 pieces of fish, loaded up with chips, and that was for the shilling. That was our supper for the three of us, you see. Now, on the basis of that, and the fact that lunches were taken, at school lunches, not from them, but it was a canteen system, you see. I think she did all right out of my 14 and sixpence. Another incident which sort of helped that along was they used to like to go to Norwich many, many weeks in the year for a day out. They'd go to the theatre or they'd go to cinema or whatever they'd go. And they used to, they did that once for me, took me with them. And thereafter, they said, "Well, we'll take you. You take your friend along, and the day is yours." The day was ours, and we were kids with nothing. We used to wander about. Now, we did it once. It was nice to see Norwich. But after, well, we were starving. We had nothing to eat. So it made it rather a difficult day. And when once she said, asked me to go again, and this went on for some time, I said, "No, I'd rather stay behind, you know, stay in Fakenham with my friends and so on." Of course, it was ridiculous walking about in the rain and the cold, you know, it was silly. She gave me a shilling to cope with my total day's requirements, you see. So, doing a little mental arithmetic, gave one the impression that she did all right. But anyway, I was very grateful that they provided a home, so that's that. And, you know, at the time, when you're youngsters, you think about these things. Perhaps you have some feelings that are not quite fair, but in hindsight, maybe we were unfair. I remember going into a local tea shop to get an egg on toast with my friend, and it was just literally full of Air Force personnel, men and women. So the whole town was full of, you know, Air Force, surrounding areas all coming into Fakenham. But those are the sorts of things that happened there. But generally, I suppose, primarily because we were with friends together and because we were all away from home, and we had our social life, the youngsters there, and I suppose because we were considered safe, that we were well off, you know, being away.
Did the war affect Fakenham in any other way apart from those sporadic bombs?
Not that I can recall, that I'm conscious of. In a sense, of course, there were blackouts, naturally. There were shortages. I can remember once we used to say, we must get a torch and a battery. We couldn't get any torch batteries because somebody had bought them all up and selling them on the, quote, black market. But there was a definite shortage of that sort of thing. I'm aware of that. I'm not too aware of too many other things that I can recall at this stage.
Now, can we talk about Hackney now, or the East End, and can you tell me what your memories of the German attacks there were?
Well, we at that time we lived in a house which was we rented the house, and we had a sub-tenant there who occupied the top section of it. And she was an old lady, a lovely lady, came from Leeds. And when all the raids were going on, I remember I was, apart from the months when I was home during the holidays, of course I was home permanently from 1942, but I was home for many months in between those times. And of course, prior to the time I came back from Fakenham to be back home permanently, I was aware of many occasions, of course, when you could see, I think it was June 40, or maybe 41, airplanes flying overhead, all the vapour trails you can see in the brilliant summer's days, you know, you can see all the aircraft flying over and so on. So we were very much aware of raids, of air raids, and very much aware of anti-aircraft batteries in Victoria Park and down Hackney Marshes and places like that. Very much aware of all that. We were aware of bombing. Now, I can't pinpoint days and times for you specifically, but I recall very vividly one particular incident when I had come home from sleeping on the platforms in the London Underground stations and bringing all the pack of gear that we used to have to carry with us every night and bring home, you know, to sleep on something and have a blanket. So I used to take for myself and my mother and so on. And I used to carry that home. Coming home, and I remember it was deemed to be a very bad night because, you know, you heard that the raids were going on for hours and hours. You weren't aware of the raids when you were in the underground station. You were just there waiting for the trains to stop that night so that you could then perhaps settle down to get some sleep, you see. But early in the morning you get up and then make your way home or make your way to your factory and so on if you were working. And I remember coming home, and this was a nice day, and conscious that it had been a bad night, and saying to my next door neighbour, who was standing outside the front of his house, down the steps led up to the front door, and he was just standing on the pavement. And I said, bad night, Mr. Black. Very rough night. He said, Rough night. Rough night, he said. It was a rough night. My son was killed last night. Air raid on the Rivoli Cinema in Whitechapel Road. He was an air raid ward, only a young man, probably about 18 or 19 at the time, maybe 20. His eldest son been killed that night. And it was indeed a very rough night. All the major buildings had wardens, air raid wardens. They were there to protect against raids and incendiary bombs and all that sort of thing. We had a very primitive form of instruction and so on. In fact, I subsequently acted as a sort of warden, but when I began to work. It wasn't a full-time post. It was just all had sort of sessions to do, one night or two nights a week or whatever it was, a certain number of hours on duty. Everybody performed these sort of tasks. And this lad is at the Rivoli Cinema doing that duty. He was killed. Bomb. Killed him and obviously many others at the time. Great tragedy. This was in the Whitechapel Road. So what can I say? Obviously a great tragedy for him and a very great sadness for all of us who knew him. So that sort of brought it very vividly, you know. But apart from that, of course, our own house, we had the back of our house, a sort of conservatory that was blown in. There was a very large bomb just landed just around the corner, and our local doctor, this is only, I suppose, as the crow flies, about 60 yards, if that. The local doctor's wife, she was killed. Bomb fell, surgery, he wasn't there at the time. She got killed. And others, many others injured, back of our house, conservatory blown in. And we had a series of incendiary bomb raids. And I can remember with an older brother of mine putting out incendiary bombs in the back, in the backyard. I remember vividly large lorries racing through our street, which is a small street that linked its way to the Victoria Park and down to the Hackney Marshes, going furiously with landmines that did not explode, unexploded landmines, taking them down to the marshes to deal with them there, going through the streets. As I say, loads of incendiary bomb raids round and about us. Local cinema, 150 yards away, 200 yards away, being smashed to smithereens, one of the early, as it were, casualties of bombing raids there. Very conscious on a nightly basis of all the docks being on fire, because as I said about this lady who used to live at the top of our house, she used to sit and watch all the fires raging throughout the night. That was, call it a... I'm sure the psychologist would have a word for it, but to me it was a sort of an experience. She was an old lady who understood suffering, and she understood deprivation. She was a Jewish lady, and to her this was another experience, and she wanted to be part of it and see it. And I quite often used to go up there and, as it were, look through the windows with her at the red sky, going on for hours and seeing all these things going on. So we knew there was so much going on. Not that we didn't need that to tell us that there were raids going on, because of course the sirens used to go on to let us know. And in between all these sort of episodes, I remember vividly once having to cycle through from Hackney to Paddington. To my brother wanted something, and he was doing more work in Reading at the time, in a factory there, specialist factory, and I had to cycle through the West End, and I'm very much aware of having to sort of cycle in and out of fire engines and you name it, everything, because shops were burning, and there was devastation all over the place just to get to Paddington, you see, to deliver to the train, as it were, things that he wanted. So one was aware all the time of enormous and horrendous bombing going on, and buildings being destroyed all around. The whole area was full of bombs of incendiary type, quite apart from the major bombs, as I say. The incident of the one on the corner of the doctor's surgery and his wife being killed, and the cinema, and knowing about that Rivoli thing. There was also the business of the tragedy of the last V bomb. Now, you know about the last V bomb. The last B bomb, these were silent rockets.
V2s.
The V2s, yes. The B ones, the V ones, again, it's something you just got used to. You saw them, and if they were passing overhead, you were okay, you didn't care. But if you knew they were coming and the noise stopped, then you really ran for shelter and dived like mad, see? Because you knew the angle at which it was going to come down, it could well hit you. But once it was overhead, you know it's passed by, and there was no chance of you being bombed. But again, it became almost a norm for a period of time, till the V2s came along. Now, a friend of mine, who was actually older than me by about 18 months, I think, at the time, he was actually a dear friend of a close friend of mine, a school friend of mine. They lived in the same Hughes Mansions in Valence Road, that was in Whitechapel. And this boy had volunteered for the Air Force, Royal Air Force, and they sent him to Canada to train. And he trained, and I remember seeing him, he came back, I remember seeing him in his uniform, he was a pilot officer. He never actually went on duty. Fine. Never actually had a posting yet. When a few days of coming back, this V2, the last V2 of the war landed, he and about 130, 140 other people were killed in Hughes Mansions. Jerry Mantis, his name was. Another tragedy of war brought home to us so vividly. And coming back to the underground stations and the air raids, can I talk about
trains?
That? Now, this was a horrible business when the raids were going on nightly. And I do remember being a part of the system of taking shelter down in the underground stations. My mother and I, mostly it was my mother and I, and my father, I beg your pardon. My father worked in Leighton at the time. Leighton Stone told you that he worked for this firm, F. Austin Leighton Limited. And we used to take all this clothing down to the station. We were at the bank. We were at Bond Street. We were at Chancery Lane. You know, people, after a while, it got to a system where they knew their place and they had their place. But I think we were, in the earlier days, we were wanderers. We weren't sure where we were. We weren't comfortable here, we weren't comfortable there. We went from one place to the other. And people used to arrange anyway, try to get their set places so that they were with their friends or whatever it was. So they had a certain community spirit down there. You see, we used to shelter locally in Victoria Park, in the underground shelters there, but then they were horrible. They were dank and dark and everything like that, and they were miserable until it became the norm to try to go to an underground station, underground station. And I used to go with my mother, all these things. Now, some people were fortunate in if they had some money, they were able to hand a few pennies or shillings to the porter, who would take their clothing for them, put it in an office or a back office or whatever, okay? people had this sort of privilege, but then they were well off. See? But others didn't have that, so they used to cart their clothing backwards and forwards. And I remember so well trying to make some form of life sleeping on the railways, in the underground station, for weeks and weeks at a time. As I said to you before, one of those instances where, having come home, Mr. Black had lost his son. But we used to do that frequently. My father used to come from work to meet us at the underground station. My mother would take some food for him. And he'd go to work in the morning. So night after night, instead of being at home. There came a point when I was sort of fed up with that business. I couldn't take it anymore. And I used to just wait for the air raid warning siren to go off. And I used to go to the Anderson shelter, which is in our little backyard. And I used to sleep through the bombs and the noise and everything throughout the night and just take my chances. That's when I remember once with a brother of mine who also knocked him out, where all the noises and the thumps that we came out, we had all these incendiary bombs and we put them out with sandbags, which everybody had sandbags sort of strewn about. You prepared for yourself or had given them to you. And we used to function those things against incendiary bombs. But there was this ritual of doing it for many months, sleeping in the underground station.
What was your address in Hackney?
I lived in number 7, Fremont, Fremont Street, Hackney. Fremont Street, number 7 Fremont Street.
Were there many properties destroyed in that immediate vicinity?
Not too many, no. I would say, apart from the doctor's house and a few around that and so on, there were lots of damage, but not a total destruction of houses that I can recall. But again, it's all relative, isn't it? You know, a bomb is a bomb. If it smashes 6 houses or 16, you see. But there weren't a whole series of large bombs landing in that particular area that totally devastated. That's not so. All those houses that are there today have been revamped, but those houses were there before the war and after the war. So they weren't devastated, but damaged. As I say, the back of our house conservatory was knocked in. Loads of claims for war damage, and people who lost things, you know, things ruined and bits of houses knocked about. But I think in 2 or 3 streets away to the right of us was a certain amount of damage. But it's strange, I don't recall too much about it, you know.
What effect did the bombing have on people's attitudes? Did it make them cooperative? Or?
Oh, yes, there was a wonderful spirit that people were cooperative. By and large, there was a degree of selfishness, as I say, with people looking after their interests about where to put their clothes, not having to carry them home at the underground station, you know, or sleeping at shelters at Dickens and Jones and places like that. The major stores all had shelters, you know, areas built for sheltering of people, and people used to go there. I know friends, some of our friends and relatives used to go to, I think it was Dickens and Jones, but Oxford Circus, Bond Street, Chancery Lane, Bank, these were our places where we used to go. And people were very much, quote, together, quote, as I recall, friendly towards each other and helpful, I would say. A good spirit, really. Very good spirit.
What about crime in the Blitz? Do you remember any of that?
I'm not aware of any crime. I'm not conscious of any crime.
People stealing things from bomb shops or houses?
No, I'm not aware of that.
Was there any crime in the blackout? The people taking advantage of the blackout to assault or mug or rape?
No, not at all. I'm not aware of that, any of that at all. And of course it was all blackout in those days, and no question about it. We all used to tape our windows over fully. against splintered glass, you know, all that sort of thing. But no, I'm not aware of any muggings, anything of that nature. People walked with total safety from that standpoint, not against the bombs. But so we had all these docks being bombed. We had air raids nightly. We had aircraft flying overhead certain periods on a daily basis. Certainly many, many, well, obviously raids, German raids causing all the bombing. Again, I can't specify the actual periods. I haven't sort of worked this out, but there were certain periods when it seemed that the raids were absolutely nightly, and then there were some periods when we had some respite from that. Then, of course, then the business of the V1s and V2s started, and it caused a great deal of devastation, you see. You used to hear all the stories of up in Ilford or Stratford or this place or that place where a bomb had gone off for V1 and V2s. But the V2, the one that, of course, I recall most vividly, is the one that did all the damage at Hughes Mansions in Valence Row, that was off Whitechapel. And where a friend of mine was killed. Now, I also recall, I'm not quite sure which year it was, but I know in the panic that people did have, there was one very well recorded incident of the Bethnal Green Underground. I'm sure you must have come across
I've
that.
I've heard of it.
It was very vivid at the time, of course, newspapers reporting it, and we used to use the Bethnal Green Underground constantly because that was our underground station, you see. We used to get a bus or walk down to Bethnal Green, it was a 10 minutes walk or something, down to the underground station. And there was this enormous tragedy of people in their rush crushing each other. So it was badly lit, and in panic. That's what it was. Panic, a badly lit underground station, causing the death of, I don't know whether it was 153 people or something like that, but a great number of people died as a direct result of war on a panic. In a situation where perhaps with a little bit of, well, certainly with hindsight, better preparations would have been made for certainly lighting and for different sorts of barriers so that people couldn't, that couldn't happen. But it's happened elsewhere, isn't it? It's happened in football grounds, I think. But there was a terrible thing. But that was a direct consequence of war in that particular area.
Did you think that the V weapons could pull the war around for the Germans?
We were nervous of it, of course. We were unquestionably worried about it, and one used to wonder why they don't send sort of hundreds of them over, you know. Because clearly if they'd sent like 10 times as many as they did, it's not war on the ground, but I don't actually think that it could ever stop a victory from forces that were at that stage much more powerful. I'm talking about our forces, you know, American, British forces and so on, Canadian. But nevertheless, it could have caused a great deal more devastation. The great thing that was stopped, well, it was stopped, you see, because there was nothing to prevent it at the time. And that's what I would say.